The hour of 4:30 being here, I'm going to call the meeting of local government to order. And we're going to, the agenda we have here, the first bill on the agenda is House File 1201. Representative Mark Quart, is he here? Oh, okay. And didn't see him hiding behind the chair.
Yeah.
And Representative Lanning, you want to move House File 1201?
I will.
So we get in front of us, and now that we got the bill in front of us, Representative Mark Quart, you can proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I do have an amendment. If we could do that to put the bill in the form and shape in which I would like it, the A1 amendment, if someone would please move that.
Representative Lanning, would you move the
Mr. Chairman,
A1 amendment?
Move the A1 amendment.
And do you want to describe the amendment first and then...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On behalf of research staff, they thought we needed this as far as to guide the meetings. This council would be a group that would meet in public. All the meetings would be publicized through the state auditor, but not have all the technicality requirements of Chapter 13D. So it makes it a little more informal, yet meeting all public requirements as far as notification and that type of thing.
Okay. Any questions of the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now if you want to explain your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate you putting it on the timeline tonight. I know we were on kind of a tight schedule with this committee and with the property tax division, so I appreciate your willingness to work with us. This is one of three bills that came out of three working groups that were set up on the property tax division. And the main goals of those three bills was to provide reform in the property tax system, provide more accountability as far as state dollars that are spent, increase value for the taxpayer, and increase efficiency in state and local government. And so Representative Lanning has one bill that provides flexibility to cities. Representative Dietrich has one that sets benchmarks for our entire property tax system in the state. And this one looks at how we can provide more value to the taxpayer. You know, our property tax aids and credit, we spend $3.4 billion. So that's what we're projected to spend in the next biennium. And yet, despite $3.4 billion going out, we as a state really don't know what we're getting for those dollars. I mean, we have almost $1 billion that go out to local government aid over the biennium, $500 million that go out to county program aid. We have about $950 million that go out to property tax and renters refunds. We have another $500 million that go out to market value homestead credits. So whether or not you're a city that gets local government aid or not, it doesn't matter. The state goes out and we spend a lot of dollars that go out to people for property tax relief. And yet, if someone asks us around the state, you know, what measure, what type of value are we giving residents? How safe do people feel in their homes? What's the quality of our street service? What's the quality of the city or county financial management in those cities? As a state, we really don't know. And when we get to times of huge budget deficits like we have right now, it's more imperative than ever that we have accountability for every single dollar that is spent, that we have some sort of benchmark to know what we're getting for those dollars. And that's what this bill will do. Let me give you a little more background on the bill. The framework, or I should say the cornerstone of this bill, is we're trying to do really three things. One is we establish a council on local results and innovation, which is ultimately going to come up with 10 benchmarks, 10 for cities and 10 for counties. They can come up with more if they want. But, for example, it might be a survey question to somebody or to your residents. How safe do you feel in your neighborhood? Or it might be something more quantifiable, like what's your part one or part two crime? Or it might be what's your bond rating in your city? It would allow us to have some sort of a framework to look at trends over time. And the formation of this council is the cornerstone of doing that. Another thing we want to do is establish a framework to encourage and help other cities and counties who are currently not doing performance measurement improvement programs to get them involved in doing that. And finally, the last thing we tried to do with this bill was to set up a framework that would assure its long-term viability so that this wasn't just a one-shot type of thing, that this would be something that would be long-term in looking at improving efficiencies, improving value to taxpayers, and keeping that long-term. This work group had six meetings. Each of them went an hour and a half. And I really want to thank all of those who participated. We had the so-called experts, those from the counties of Olmsted, Hennepin, Beltrami, Dakota, and Scott. We had folks from the cities of Minneapolis, St. Cloud, and Woodbury who are doing these performance measurement systems. They are doing amazing work. We have a couple testifiers today on this. So we involved the experts, we involved the cities and counties, we involved assessors, Department of Revenue, the state auditor, Rebecca Otto, has been just a tremendous help throughout this process. And so we tried to involve as many as we could, including the public. So with that little bit of a background, I would like Mr. Hines to take us through the bill if we could. And then I do have a couple testifiers, if we could, Mr. Chair.
And we're trying to get three bills done tonight, so we can...
We will make it, we'll keep it quick.
Keep it concise, and if you state your name for the tape, and...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Steve Hines with the House Research Department. I was staff person to the division, or to the work group that came up with this proposal. And you have the bill summary, hopefully in your folders on the bill. I'm just going to run through that very quickly. Section 1 of the bill creates the Council on Local Results and Innovation, consisting of 11 members, 8 of which are appointed by the legislature, non-legislative members appointed by legislators, and then along with a representative from the Association of Counties, the League of Cities, and the State Auditors. And basically, there's sort of three duties for the council. The first one that they would need to complete by February 15th of next year is to develop an initial set of these 10 performance measurements and standards that Representative Marquardt alluded to. So try to come up with, a set of 10 for the cities and counties that want to get into this program, that want to start reporting, to kind of steer them into here's the kinds of things we'd like to get reports on for comparison, you know, across cities and counties, but more appropriate on time series as we go along. But that's the first order of business, is coming up with that set of 10 of each, 10 for cities, 10 for counties. Then the second requirement is given another year by February of 2011 to develop minimum standards for cities and counties, and cities and counties want to get into a more detailed performance measurement system to sort of set up standards which those would have to meet. And as you hear from the testifiers, there's lots of knowledge out there about these systems and how they work that they will hopefully be able to come up with a good set of minimum standards. And then the final task is a more general charge, to just be a resource to all the cities and counties in the state that want to get into performance measurement, and all the people in those that are doing the performance measurements, for them to trade information. Then each year this council is required to report on either the development of its standards or the results that cities and counties who participate are getting by February of each year to the tax committee on the developments in the last year. Subdivision for the operation of the council basically provides that the council would choose its own a chair, and that the administration of the council operations will kind of rotate with the chair and the members kind of dividing the workload amongst themselves, with kind of the state auditor's offices being the place of that we could nail down as the definite place where the meetings would be posted, and they would post things on their website. So that would be the place to look for sure, but without a commitment to really provide administrative services support to the council. We put the termination of January 1st of 2019, just because it was advised to put sunsets on these kinds of councils. And then section two relates then to the to what the cities and counties are able to do or asked to do. Subdivision one requires that a county or city that wishes to participate in this program to file its results in the case of its performance measures by July 1st each year with the state auditor. And also asks them to sort of also provide those results to their taxpayers or to their citizens through a number of different mechanisms they can use, including a publication, a mailing, or publication on their website. Subdivision 2, then, there are some benefits to participation. If a city or county chooses to participate by providing the minimum, developing the minimum standard, or the minimum performance measures, a set of performance measures, they get a reimbursement of 25 cents per capita, up to a maximum of $25,000 for each jurisdiction in the first year. And also in the first year, besides that monetary compensation, they're also exempt from levy limits and truth and taxation hearing requirements in that first year, 2010. Then the next paragraph in 2011, there's sort of two different ways they can participate. If they just choose to provide the standard set of measures, that will allow them to collect the $25,000 minimum, a 25 cent per capita reimbursement. But then secondarily, they can also choose to begin to get into the more elaborate, more involved, more detailed set of performance measures, and then that would allow them to be exempt from levy limits and truth and taxation hearings. And then in the future, the same thing in 2012 and thereafter, those same two levels of participation would be available to every city and county. And Subdivision 4 just provides the appropriation for the reimbursement.
Mr. Chair, I do have a few testifiers.
Okay, Mr. Representative Markport, if you want to call your testifiers.
All right, it's Mr. Tim Walsh from Scott County and Mr. Jay Strobel from the City of Minneapolis.
And if you want to identify yourself with the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tim Walsh. I'm the Director of Health, Human Services, and Corrections for Scott County.
Okay, Mr. Walsh, you want to go ahead?
Yes. This is a county testimony in support of the Council on Local Results and Innovation. First of all, I think what this bill does is it's going to help counties to show the amount of service we provide that's of value to county citizens. I think it's also going to show how well we do that service, the quality of what we do. I think it's going to show that we have good impact on people's lives, that we actually help to better people's lives. And then finally, I think that it will show that we can show improvement in how we impact communities. The real key for a good performance measurement or management system is that you got to take good data and then apply it to practice. That's really what it is. And so a good performance management system helps you to do that. It helps you to translate the best intelligence you have, the best wisdom that you have, the best practices that are out there, and translate that into the best results for people. I want to just use my time, if you will, to relate to three quick stories about how data could be used on the county level to improve the results that we provide to citizens. First of all, in Dakota County, when we were studying the development of a juvenile correctional facility, there were experts that told us that we would have to design a facility that was 400 beds large. And we looked at the evidence of what works to turn kids' lives around in the juvenile correctional system. We took a look at our data, and we decided that we could get by with a facility that was one-tenth that size. And that's exactly what we did, and we predicted that that would serve our needs till the year 2004, which it did. Quick story. He is in Anoka County. At that time, we were being told that we needed to separate out our juvenile sex offenders, and we should really have our own facility for those sexual offenders. But as you look at the evidence for juvenile sex offenders, you find that with effective treatment, sometimes over 95% of them don't return to the system. And so we used the best data that was available at that time, and we actually treated those kids within the programs that we had. And we took a look back at our impact on those kids' lives, and not a single one of the sex offenders that we had treated during the 3 years that we studied in 2 years had reoffended. So I think that's pretty impressive. And finally, in Scott County, as we look at how Scott County is using this right now, what we found is that we can use the current data within our child welfare system to work with families to keep children in home, to keep them safe by having those families support those children in the community, to take that family's natural support, take their community, and to build safety plans around children. And we're experiencing excellent results in that area. What I'd like to emphasize for this bill, why it, I think, is an excellent bill and structured very well, is when we look at it, it is voluntary, first of all. I think it is built, it's going to be very flexible to the counties. It's going to be customizable, whether you're a small county and rural, or whether you're a large county and metro. It is it's going to allow for taking the best practices through the state auditor's office and applying those best practices in a way that is scalable and cost-efficient. And it's going to offer guidance that will work to both small counties, medium-sized counties, and large counties. And then finally, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. What you're going to find in as you talk to various representatives from counties is that we really do have different problems, different risks, different needs, depending on which county that you're talking to. And we need to respond, if you will, on the ground to those needs, whether that be in the child welfare system, the correctional system, the public health system. We're responding to local needs. And a customized performance management system based on the best practices is going to help us to respond locally to those needs. And so I want to lend Scott County support to this bill. It was well-crafted. And it was really responsive to our concerns, but also to our input as to what will work for all 87 counties.
Thank you. And Representative Diskin, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. Mr. Walsh, does Scott County in general or your department in particular have performance standards that you set and you live by?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We've developed a pilot performance management system within all of our health and human services programs. We based it on a model from Mark Friedman, which is easily accessible on the web and very cost-effective. We sold liberally from that. And then we're using that model. We're using that model to start looking at our results in every area, where we're performing up to our expectations and the taxpayers' expectations, and where we're performing below those expectations and need to improve.
Representative Biscombe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then to Representative Marquardt, it doesn't sound like there is anything currently in law which would prevent a local unit of government, county, or city from creating these performance standards, and in fact it sounds like there'd be tremendous incentive already in law if it is to improve efficiency and get the biggest bang for the dollar. So I guess then, Representative Marquardt, what do you see in current law that is preventing municipalities from going in this direction, and why is this legislation necessary?
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Diskin, that's a great question. And there's nothing in current law that would prevent that. But the fact of the matter is there's very few counties that do it and very few cities that are doing this. And I, in just listening to the testimony in this group that met, There is no doubt in my mind that if we were to move forward and the more cities would get involved and trade a little bit of a carrot out there and have kind of a resource, this council would also serve as a resource for those who wanted to do that, that you're going to see more efficiency in government and better value to the taxpayer. Just as Mr. Walsh mentioned, you heard three instances there where they could have spent a lot more and not received the value. They spent less and got more value. And if we could do that around the state, I think in this time of budget crunches, it would be a benefit to all. So there is no prohibition right now. I just think we need to get it going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say rhetorically and Representative Marcourt could respond. I understand the need or the desire to want to use a carrot. But the carrots, you know, in time of drought and famine, right, are few and far between. And I'm wondering if it isn't incumbent upon us as the state, which create the local units of government, to start using the stick to get the necessary efficiencies for property taxpayers throughout the state of Minnesota.
Representative Marcourt.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. As Representative Biskins knows, as former wrestling coaches, we have used both the carrot and the stick when we deal with things, but quite well taken.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Representative Marcourt, I just had a question on the last page under appropriation. Assuming everybody does this and it's such a great idea, and it's a quarter ahead or however I understand this, up to $25,000. The sum sufficient to meet the requirements of the section is annually appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Revenue. If everybody did it, what would that be?
Representative Mark.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scalzi, since we capped it at $25,000 per entity, like Hennepin County that has, what, $1.2 million or something? I mean, it wouldn't. But if... Let's say we wouldn't have had a cap on it, the maximum would have been $2.25 million. Would have been $1 million for cities, which is one out of, you know, $4 million, and then $1.25 out of $5 million in counties. But since it's capped, it'd probably be $1.5 million at max, I would think, if all entities did it.
Representative Scalzi.
And then thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marcourt. And then where would that money come from... What part of the budget, or would there be other revenue to offset it?
Representative
Marcourt. Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, it would be part of the property tax aids and budget. So ultimately, $1.5 million would have to come from another area to make that work.
Representative Scalzi. Mr. Strobel, if you want to give your testimony, say your name for the tape and then proceed.
Jay Strobel, Director of Planning and Management, City of Minneapolis. I'd like to... Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee for having me here this afternoon. I want to talk briefly about three quick points, a little bit on the City of Minneapolis Performance Measurement System, how this system has benefited city management, elected officials, and the residents, and a few comments in support of this bill. City of Minneapolis has a very rigorous and integrated performance measurement system where we use measures to monitor progress on the city's goals and department business plans. It's helped inform the development of our budget, manage day-to-day decisions, and also reporting results to residents. Two specific ways we do this are through our weekly results progress conferences, where a panel including the mayor, a council member, the city coordinator, reviews and holds accountable a different department each week against their key performance measures. These sessions are open to the public, and the materials are made available online. The second thing that I wanted to highlight is with the financial help of the Sloan Foundation, we're in the final stages of developing a website to report out the performance information of interest to residents. We've done this in coordination with the Minneapolis Public Schools, the Park Board, the county, Hennepin County, and the city. In terms of benefits for city managers, measurement is becoming part of the culture in the city of Minneapolis and is seen as an invaluable tool in making daily and strategic decisions. For elected officials with greater knowledge of programmatic performance, it has helped our elected officials make better policy and budget decisions. For residents, we believe our performance measurement system benefits residents and taxpayers not only because we are more transparent with our measures, but through our constant attention to performance measurements, we feel like we're better able to make management decisions and improve our delivery of services to our residents. Finally, in support of this bill, there is a growing national trend for more and more governments to use performance measurements. Not all governments have caught on to this, where we see it as just a very good management practice. Specifically about this bill, though, it is voluntary. There's no mandate that any city or county participates. Two, it creates a practitioner peer-led council to help identify a small set of comparable measures and highlight innovative service delivery practices from across states. Third, it encourages local governments to use measures as a management tool and to inform decision-making. And fourth, it increases government transparency with citizens to deserve to know how their government is performing. Finally, overall, this bill is about empowering and supporting cities and counties to use performance measures with the ultimate hope of improving service delivery and cost effectiveness for taxpayers across the state. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Eastland. Okay. Marquardt, you had a comment?
Mr. Chair, I have one more testifier, very quick, State Auditor Rebecca Otto, who this is kind of a framework for long-term is going to be through her office. If she could just say a few words, I think she can't make a later meeting.
I saw she was here, and I was going to ask her.
Barry, if that would be all right, Mr. Chair.
Representative, State Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rebecca Otto, Minnesota State Auditor. I've seen a lot of things floating around for local governments this session, and this one really caught my interest. And I said two words, but you have to decide on the carrots and what the state can afford or not afford. What I see and why I wanted to be involved in this council is because I believe there's a weigh-in piece that the public can weigh in and maybe be surveyed on what their perception of the results are, which I think would be very beneficial. A lot of local, state, of truth and taxation hearings don't get well attended. This may be a replacement for that. And I think anytime locals know what's going on, you know, in terms of what their taxpayer dollars pay for is critical. And so I see there, actually this is a really neat concept. It's just a matter of what you decide is appropriate for the carrot. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rebecca. Hey, Otto. I served with Rebecca. Representative Eastland, you had a question for the...
Yeah, I guess maybe just a couple of general questions. Help me understand, is the council...
Thank you. Is the council going to create a kind of one set of performance standards? Is that kind of the goal that is going to become the model for all local governments? Help me understand that.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you. You know, initially as we started working, we were going to try to develop 10 as part of the working group. I mean, by the end of February, and it became apparently clear early on that, just as you mentioned, it's tough to do that. So their task is going to be, what are going to be 10 for cities and 10 for counties that everyone could plug into? Probably 3 or 4 of these 10 would probably be survey-driven, which means residents would be in the driver's seat on determining their quality. The other, what we're initially looking at, is data that would be readily available, like crime statistics and other things. But as those who are doing it each and every day, they know best. So that's going to be the task, is to come up. But Representative Eastland, there would be 10 for the cities and 10 for the counties that everyone then would need to report on those 10. And each year, this council is going to report back to the tax committee, and they might come back and say after a certain year, you know, this number 7 really doesn't work, so we're going to replace it with, although we'd like to get some consistency over a year so we can start seeing trends. And one thing, let's say you've got communities that rate high in public safety. People are going to start looking at, why is this community that's spending roughly the same amount of money doing this much better on public safety, maybe on this one or something else, and you start getting best practices and that type of thing. So we think the comparative data is going to be really useful in the future also.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's that kind of uniformity model that I'm kind of struggling with a little bit here. We already have a number of local jurisdictions. I imagine the larger ones probably all do some form of this. they're currently. I mean, I think Minneapolis reported kind of what they're doing, and I'm sure lots of local governments have already gone down the road of establishing some kind of benchmarks and performance measurements and those kinds of things. And now we're gonna create a committee that somehow is going to create a kind of a uniform set of standards. It's just something we like to do that legislatively. We like to create a model that everybody has to follow and think that that's going to get us someplace. But it seems like there's so many unique differences in cities of different size, counties, and to create some kind of a standard. I understand. Is there a longer term objective as to why these performance measures need to be the same, or why couldn't it be each organization designing their own, and so that we would have many experimental models happening out there, and we'd have a way to see what was more effective, and give locals basically that decision. If they want to start to look at this model, they could look at how to develop their own.
Representative Markford.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, and we talked about that quite a bit, just what you're saying, and these 10 kind of benchmarks or measurements, that would really be a minimum. What we would really encourage is, as these counties and cities have done, is to actually go to a full-blown performance measurement system where they measure everything, but these 10 would be, see, as a state, I feel we should at least have some benchmarks, consistent benchmarks, as a state, to say if someone asks me, how are you spending your $3.4 billion every 2 years in property taxation credit? What are you getting as far as public safety? We'd have something to answer for that. But that would just be a very, very minimal, and hopefully, working with this council, that would be a sounding board and so forth. Other cities and counties would have a larger program. I've also been informed, I forgot about this, but both Florida and North Carolina have systems like this that have been working successfully. So we wouldn't be the first to do that, but they have. But the 10 benchmarks would be the minimum, and hopefully cities and counties would actually have more elaborate systems, as you heard described here today.
Representative Eastland.
I guess then going a little farther down the road, I mean, as this thing moves down the road and unfolds and counties and cities begin to develop this, the council ultimately is collecting the data, is that right? And bringing it back to the legislature, is that the way I understand that this is would work?
Representative Markford.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, the way it would work is that cities and counties would have to report their data to the state auditor by July 1st. The state auditor already compiles and puts out on the website all sorts of information on cities, and that would then put that on their website. And then this group, the council, would look every year, and they would have an annual report to the tax committee that would also report these results, but also just kind of how things are working and what they might think for the future, and the things that are, you know, maybe they'll throw a benchmark out and add another one, but it ultimately would be published on the state auditor's website.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the state auditor, I'm confused about Ms. Otto, Auditor Otto, she made one comment in her comment. She said that this could create a framework for long-term reporting, and I guess so. Is there kind of a long-term goal already in place? Have we already decided that this is the route we want to go, and this is step one in the process? We're going to put a carrot out there, and then we're going to start down the road, and then there is no turning back. I guess the question is how do we know that everybody's going to want to go down this road? And is it practical that every local government, no matter what their size, go down this road? And is this a one-size-fits-all kind of a thing in the end anyway? I guess is my question.
Representative Eastland, I mean, the bottom line is, yes, at least 10 benchmarks. That was kind of the bottom line, so that the state could be accountable for the dollars spent. And also, we felt this was a way in which to improve taxpayer value and city and county efficiency. It's a voluntary program. we're hoping ultimately everyone will get involved with it. And as Representative Briskin said, you know, they can do that now. But we do think, just by even having this council, that cities and counties could say, you know, they could call someone and say, how do you get started on this? And, you know, how could we plug into it? We don't really have a framework right now for someone to plug into. And we have cities and counties doing this, but there's nothing concise or consistent, and we think this would provide a real good framework for that. But I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I mean, the benchmarks is what we want. How it might go in the long term, I think that might be...
The auditor, I see. Auditor Otto is trying to creeping up there to answer. if we could move along so we can
go and work with
it. Yes, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Eastland, really good questions. And as a state auditor, I understand that there's a huge difference between a Minneapolis and a Tracy, Minnesota. And so I want to be on that council again just because, and we're making sure there's an entity from, you know, they're smaller, because we have to make sure that we're making something that does work. Perhaps on the council, I told Representative Marquardt, if something's not working, we can come back and tell the tax committee that. And also, maybe they'll decide that it's appropriate to have benchmarks for cities over 2,500 and cities under 2,500. That might be the conclusion of the council, and hopefully there's flexibility for that. So I think, and I also said to Representative Marquardt, because it's new and different, I mean, it's really promoting good government in Minnesota, and if we can get a bigger bang for our buck, I think that's good for everybody. The carrots you have to decide. But I think that, you know, the idea is good, and the council will be able to work with it. You have locals serving on the council, guiding it, so it's not people who don't know what they're living with. So I think there's a lot of good things, I would trust the council to kind of come back and report to in terms of how it's working and how it might be able to be adjusted. So.
I'll just say, I mean, one final comment. I had a few more questions, but I won't belabor it anymore. I guess I think give a lot of credit for people looking at ways to make government more efficient, and I think of what Krinke always said: government efficiency is kind of an oxymoron. So to some degree, I have some concerns about that. I think when we're looking at creating more government to make government more efficient, I look at that, and that puts up a red flag in my mind. And so as I see more bureaucracy kind of happen, I think the cities that have this have done it. They've done it without this. They've done it because it did make good fiscal sense. They've done it because it did allow them to operate more efficiently. And it seems like that's a much better motivator than in many respects. And so that's just a comment. And then the other thing that I guess I have some concerns about is that immediately what we do in entertaining this program, if a city or a county or somebody wants to enter this program, the first immediate thing that happens is they're exempt from truth and taxation hearing requirements. And I think when you made your opening comments, you said we're looking for accountability and value to the taxpayer. And the piece that we have in place right now, maybe it's not well used, I'll grant you that. Maybe it's not well used, but that's the piece that we have in place right now. And I'm a little concerned that we just throw out that piece because we're starting down a road that's supposed to give us a better result. We don't know that. And I guess I'm a little concerned about that aggressive of an approach. I mean, I would like to see at least some ability to evaluate this thing and have the taxpayers be able to evaluate this thing. Maybe the truth in taxation thing stays in effect and this becomes a big part of that first, I don't know, but I just think there's some issues here that I'm struggling with when I look at going down a new road and just leaving everything that we've had in the past that's worked behind.
Auditor Otto, yes.
Hard to say that. I know. That's why it's really hard. Mr. Chair, members, very quickly, Representative Eastland, I don't like more bureaucracy either. In fact, I flinch when it happens. And so I said to Representative Marquardt, free and cheap. You know, and so nobody's getting paid on this council. For me to do surveys of residents around the state actually is almost free, believe it or not. So that was what was in mind when we were doing it, because I said we just don't have much staff or anything, so we can't provide the supportive services. There's a few things we can do. So I'm with you on that one. And also, I want the public to be able to do a survey to weigh in to say we like it or don't like it. And so I think there's that accountability without having, you know, rooms empty on truth and taxation day.
Representative Eastland. Is there anybody from the audience who would like to speak for or against the bill? See no one rushing to the microphone. Representative Lanning renews his motion as amended to pass, to recommend to pass and re-refer to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations House File 1201, House File 1201 as amended, to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have. Motion for the amendment. Motion prevails, yes.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much. Thank you.
Lynn. The next bill on the agenda for tonight is House File 1195, Representative Lanning. And again, we've got another bill after this that we'd like to get done tonight, so if we could be concise, and I know everybody wants to get fully vetted, but we can be concise in our comments and go forward from there. Representative Lanning, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1195 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, etc.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I believe getting a bill heard in that committee, you have to actually say
the whole thing.
Over and over and over.
Well, you have an amendment. Do you want to put that on first and get the bill in the...
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
You want to explain your amendment?
Yes, I will. Thank you. The amendment clarifies two provisions in the bill. The first one was requested by the folks, the Library Association, wanting to clarify what the library maintenance of effort provision really meant. Ms. Dalton could explain the details of that. And the second amendment basically clarifies provision, making sure that we don't cause a problem with outside funding coming in terms of the matching requirements. And so is a technical correction. Ms. Dalton could say more about the library amendment.
Ms. Dalton?
For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. The Library Association requested that the change in paragraph A of Article 1, Section 2 be delayed until 2010, so we didn't end up doing some double counting in the reductions allowed under the Library Maintenance Effort.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? If not, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Do you want to explain your bill? And
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As we all know, for many years, cities, counties, townships, and schools have been asking for more flexibility, giving them more ability to make local decisions, and also to get some relief from mandates that have been problematic or unfunded, etc. Given our current budget problems and the likely major cuts in local aid, I think that now is the time for us to provide some relief to local units of government. And as a result, Chair of the Property Tax Division, Chair Marquardt, set up three work groups. You've heard his report and bill that came out of his group. Representative Dietrich also had a group that has been working on state property tax system benchmarks and critical indicators. That bill is also going to state and local government operations. And then the third is the bill I have before you now. I want to thank my colleagues on the work group, Representatives Loeffler, Tilbury, and Detmer. They're all co-authors of the bill, as well as helping us put this bill together. Let me tell you the process we went through in devising this bill. We asked all local units of government to give us a list of all of the mandates that they consider to be problematic or areas where they would like to be given some more flexibility in terms of local decision making. We got long lists, and we knew that it was impossible to incorporate many of their requested items of relief. And so we asked them first to narrow down maybe the top 10, and then we asked them to narrow it down even more, so maybe three or four of their top mandates that they would like to see addressed. And then we asked members of our work group to evaluate that list. We had a list with all of the items, the top items for each of the local units of government. We asked our work group members to evaluate that. They indicated which ones they thought we ought to incorporate in the bill and which ones they did not think we should include. And we pulled together a draft bill. And then our work group held an informal hearing, giving everyone an opportunity to evaluate the items that we had in our draft bill. And as a result of that, we revised the bill. We pulled out some things that appeared to be controversial and we thought would bog this bill down unnecessarily. And so what we have before you now is a scaled-down version of our mandate relief and flexibility bill. Let me just briefly highlight the sections. And I understand, I've been advised that Article 1 is primarily under the purview of the Tax Committee and Property Tax Division, but we're going to just give you some information with regard to that. Article 2 is the article that is mostly under the purview of this committee, and so that's where we would need to focus our attention. Articles 3 and 4 will be mostly under the purview of the State and Government Operations Reform group, which will be holding a hearing hopefully later this week. With respect to Article 1, Article does four things. First of all, it eliminates the need for a truth in taxation hearing. Now, I want to make it clear that the truth in taxation notice still has to be given. But we're saying that the hearing, which typically comes way too late in the process, should be eliminated. I'm one, as mayor of my city, that I chaired many truth in taxation hearings. And my main frustration is the frustration that's been shared by cities around the state, other local units of government, that it really comes too late in the process. It kind of gives citizens the impression that we can change things so late and only a few weeks, couple weeks before the budget, new budget year actually begins. And so to that extent, I don't think this has been a productive thing to do. But taxpayers are still going to get notice. And the notice that they will get from the local unit of government will also indicate now when and where their body is going to meet so that citizens can come much earlier to share their current concerns or questions with regard to that taxpayer's notice. The next thing it does is to provide some relief to library maintenance of effort. Local units of government asked us to repeal the library maintenance of effort. And we chose not to do that, but rather provide some relief that two things that the provisions provide. Number one, it used to be that in every 2 years, maintenance of effort was determined by the previous 2 years. Now we're saying previous 3 years. And then the library folks have indicated to us that they understand that they need to share with in the cuts that are going to be coming to local units of government, and but they ought to be proportional. And I guess I'd ask Ms. Dalton, this library maintenance of effort thing gets very complicated, and Ms. Dalton is the expert on that, if I could have her share that.
Ms. Dalton?
Members of the committee, it's Article 1, Section 2, that is the library maintenance of effort. Paragraph A is what Representative Lanning has already discussed. Previously, if a county or city raised its library maintenance of effort voluntarily, or it was required every other year after that to continue spending at that higher level. What this bill does is it says that they can spend at the lowest level in the last 3 years. And so this allows cities and counties to do some one-time spending increases for libraries to handle capital equipment and things like that without it being permanently rolled into their base. Paragraphs B and C are the paragraphs dealing with the A cuts, both the unallotments and A cuts for 2009 and 2010. Basically, it's saying that local governments can reduce the maintenance of effort by the lesser of 10% or the decrease in a city's or county's revenue base, which is levy plus aid, whatever that percentage was. But paragraph C says that nobody can go underneath the required minimum maintenance of effort. The required minimum maintenance of effort right now for libraries is 0.82% of tax base, or $12.62. We have about 30 counties who are actually just levying the minimum, and so those ones are not going to be allowed to do any reductions.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next provision says that there should be no more new maintenance of effort pieces of legislation enacted that can be effective immediately. In fact, the provision says that after January 1 of 2009, that anything that's enacted cannot take effect until after January 1 of 2012. And so that there would be adequate time to evaluate that maintenance of effort proposal to indicate whether or not it makes sense or doesn't. And the last major provision in Article 1 is the repealing of levy limits. And as members know, levy limits have been on and off again over the years many times. In fact, I was supplied a 12-page history of levy limits, and I won't bore you with it, but if anybody would like a copy, it's interesting reading how levy limits have come and gone, and the various things that have been done with regard to it. It's very difficult to argue against levy limits when we're increasing aid to local government. But when we're in a cycle where we're going to decrease aid to local government, levy limits become very problematic, and so local units of government have been asking that these levy limits be lifted, and that's what this bill would do. Then with respect to Article 2, there's a bunch of miscellaneous items that were brought to us by cities, counties, townships, and schools. And Mr. Chairman, I know that we have representatives from all of those groups. Maybe to save some time, we could let them address the items in particular that they're concerned about, the ones that they requested us to provide, but it's a series of miscellaneous mandates that have been problematic to local units of government.
Before we go to that, Representative Lanning, on line 27.3, there's a blank dollar amount. Do you have a figure to put in there, or?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, no. What page?
Page 27, line 3. It has to do with the Legislative Commission on Mandate Reform, and again, that's probably in the purview of the Committee of Local Government or of State Government Operations.
Yes,
but
I do not have a recommendation at this point, Mr. Chairman, and recognizing that at this point in time, new appropriations are going to be very hard to come by.
If you want to call your witnesses up to the table, and
okay.
And if we can be concise in our statements and then our questions and answers, we can move along here and get more people to the table. If you want to state your name for the tape, then proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Do you want us to limit our comments just to the Article 2, or should we comment on all of those that we asked for in this bill?
I think we're dealing with Article 2 and some portions of Article 3 and 4, but if you can limit it to what we have purview over, that'd be great for time's sake.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just point out the ones that we asked for at AMC. Section 5 in Article 2, the ability for counties to be open less than 5 days a week, the courthouse. That's an issue that Southern Minnesota has brought up. We have a number of counties who, in conversations with their bargaining units, have been interested in potentially going to a four-day work week to come up with some cost savings. It is our intention that be bargained for with those bargaining units, and we've been in discussions with AFSCME and other groups. And so at this time, we're comfortable with the language. I think that we might add some additional language in the next committee if they feel it's needed from the labor side. But it is our intention that would be something worked out between employees and employers before they'd go to a four-day work week. The booking fee in Section 10 is something that we supported. And also I want to actually thank the author for including the ability to file for group waivers in Article 3, Section 1. And I also just want to say, in broader terms, I want to thank Representative Lanning for the process on this. It was really a kind of a breath of fresh air. He took a lot of input from us and from other groups, and we appreciate that. And there are a lot of items in here that are very meaningful to local governments. We try to balance our budgets going forward and get creative and kind of get rid of some of the old mandates that we feel maybe aren't as needed anymore. Thank you.
I'll jump in, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're the statewide association representing 853 from cities. And we were active participants in Representative Lanning's working group, came to all six meetings, and a lot of you have seen probably a 20-page mandate release document that we've had outlining a whole host of ideas, some of which are in the bill before you. Section 1 of Article 2, best value contracting, is something that we brought forward. It goes after a bill I believe you worked on, Mr. Chair, 2 years ago, dealing with best value contracting, and simply strikes the limit on the number of contracts that a city or local government could use each year. We haven't heard any controversy on that. Jumping down to Section 7, dealing with contracts and day labor, this is more of a technical and clarifying issue that we were able to work on with Ms. Dyson, I believe. And then Section 9 of this miscellaneous article deals with pooling for insurance. And we brought this idea forward. I know there are others in the room that can speak to more of the details, but it would allow a city or other local unit of government to not pool, if you will, for both the retirees and the actives in terms of the their health insurance benefits. And it's somewhat related, it is related to the Gatsby 45 requirement, and there's a substantial cost to local governments in having to account for the costs associated with that. I think under the law, cities are required to do it every couple of years, and it can cost somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple thousand dollars to account for that. And I know Mr. Deans with the school boards is here and can probably speak to that in more detail if you need that. That's all I would have for today. I want to thank Representative Lanning for working so hard on this, and you, of course, taking up the bill.
Representative Bernstein, you had a question.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And to this question of Article 2, Section 9, and I don't know if it's someone from the school board would be more appropriate, but do you have any concerns that this could increase health care costs for employees that are about to retire and make early retirement too costly? I think any time you make these kinds of changes with health care these days, there could be some unintended consequences and increase the cost for the employee. Do you have any reaction or thoughts about that?
Ms. O'Rourke? Or
it's okay, I'll thank you, Mr.
School Board Member. Why don't you identify yourself for the tape?
My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We also are in support of this section, Article 2, Section 9 on retirees. And what it actually has to do is by separating the two pools, we are able to let each pool pay for their costs. And what Gatsby does is there's the actives have an implied rate that they subsidize the retirees on. And we have to carry that implied rate on our books as a school board, and you see them in our audit reports every year coming forward. This would be a way to address a significant portion of OPEB costs for cities, counties, and schools by getting rid of this implicit subsidy of active for the retirees. So we're asking the members to bear the true costs, and early retirees have a choice on whether to retire or not to retire, and it's really from the time they choose to retire till, in fact, they hit Medicaid. And it's just that small portion of time, but for school districts, it could be millions of dollars.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate your answer. I mean, I think when you said you're asking the members to bear the cost, and that's my understanding as well, and we may want to talk about that or revisit that issue because I do have concerns about it.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Ms. Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just want to follow up on that because that's really what the only provision school districts have in here besides the truth and taxation guarantee. And we are suggesting that that implied or blended rate be proportioned among each member. We do not think it would impact any. Pearson has retired under the present system. We have a court case that says if you retired under one, you continue to get that. So if you presently retired, that wouldn't impact anyone presently. And it really has to do with the present bargaining agreement. And I suggest to you these are difficult times, and school districts are going to be down to bare bones looking on where to go. And we can't pay our beginning teachers the amount they truly deserve. And so this is a way for them to get the compensation they deserve and for the retirees to take that on themselves.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And wouldn't that, though, sort of interfere with the bargaining? I'm just kind of saying that if this is what employees are assuming, and now by law we would be interfering with that negotiating process, would seem to be a little troublesome, much like we're negotiating with Section 5. We're not negotiating with Section 9, but we're putting it in law.
Ms. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, if you look at the language on 2033, it says the local government is not required to pull you it. We could still do that going forward and understand we're looking at those costs. But this gives us just another way to look at it, and this is really the federal accounting standard we're measured against, that the public is going to see show up in our audit reports going forward. And for some districts, this is going to be a very large number that we're going to look at having to fund forward. And unlike cities and counties, we cannot levy our taxpayer for retirees benefits. Those are something that has to come out of our general fund. And any increase or any change is borne by that school district.
Representative Scalzi.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate those issues, and I know they're important. I guess, has anybody tried to quantify what the overall savings that this bill is going to accomplish for local governments at different levels? I mean, there's things that mandates that are being relieved in here. Do we know what it's actually saving in dollars, roughly? Has anybody looked at that?
Representative Lanning looks like he's coming to the microphone.
Good handle.
Representative Lanning.
Now, Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland, we simply haven't had time or the opportunity to collect from all local units of government how much each one of these provisions would save them. I can assure you that there is a significant amount of savings that would accrue to local units of government here, but I don't think anybody at this point in time can put a number to that. This bill has been put together just in the last month, and maybe some folks have calculated something on a small, one of their minor portions, but overall we don't have that information.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the reason I ask that is because one of the things that we're doing in here, everybody seems to be on board that it's going to be saving money, you know, at the local level. There's some mandates that are going to be taken off. We're going to give local governments the ability to have more wiggle room and do kind of what they want to do, have some more say about what they do in their own local communities. And then one of the mandates that we're lifting in here is the levy limits. I guess when I think back, I mean, it's so often thrown around in this body that if we put mandates on, we are responsible for raising the property tax. If we take mandates off, I guess my question is, it would be nice to know that there's going to be some pressure taken off of property tax. And how can we know that that's going to occur, or is our local government just going to give it the mandates and then fill up the gap like so often happens? If there is no kind of gauge to understand how this relates to, you know, local levies.
Representative Lannis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eastland, yes, this bill would take some pressure off, would reduce some of the costs, but the mandate mentioned in here is only that they're only the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we've got hundreds of other mandates that are also affecting costs on the part of local government. And we have no good process for evaluating those mandates along the way. I think what's very unproductive is for the legislature to take all these on one at a time. And we've just taken on a few here in this bill. There's a whole slug of these throughout the whole system. And we need to have a process going forward for how we can identify those, evaluate them, and maybe even determine at that point what the savings really will be. But I don't think we're in that position to do it yet at this point in time.
Ms. Dalton, you look like you
have... Yes, she has some information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't know exactly what is going to happen to levy limits. Those of us who actually modeled the impact of levy limits are the staff from Senate and House and from the Department of Revenue are actually meeting right now to try to figure out how we are going to determine the impact of levy limits, the impact of removing levy limits, given the size of the proposed aid cuts that are coming down the pike. We're guessing they probably aren't going to be much smaller than what the governor is proposing, and there's always the possibility they can be larger. And there are some real behavioral issues as it comes to modeling these levy limits, because we're talking in some cases of cities who are going to be facing 20% and 30% levy increases if we actually enact the governor's LGA or county program aid cuts, and whether a city can psychologically do that with or without levy limits is a really good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate, you know, this is hard, a tough issue, and I mean, it's been something the legislature has just not taken on, and I got to compliment you for taking this issue on. The concern I do have, though, is we are often given the credit of raising property taxes when we put mandates on, and it would be nice to see a commensurate recognition of that, that if we do go down the road of starting the mandate relief, and I fully agree, I appreciate this, and I think we should go much farther. I'd like to see us go much farther, much faster. But I think then there should also be a recognition that if the mandates come off, that you know, there is some responsibility that needs to go back to the local units for those issues. That was more of a comment. And then I want to go to one other issue, because I'm always nervous when we take oversight of the taxpayer out of the process. And you mentioned, Representative Lanning, that the truth in taxation comes way too late in the process. I think you had some good suggestions about getting that input earlier. Why wouldn't we just move the truth in taxation process up so that it does have some significance before we just kind of get rid of it?
Representative Lanning.
That's a question we have talked about a great deal in the tax committee, and Ms. Dalton can probably give you a better response to that than I can.
Well, I think that's something for the tax committee, and we're trying to get through with what we have to take care of here, but if you want to answer quickly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, there's some timing issues on when we actually have certified levies or proposed certified levies and when we have tax bases used in calculating those individual truth and taxation notices. That's why it gets very difficult to move them up.
Yeah, I have two more quick questions. I'll just ask them at the same time, and you can respond. One is the best value thing. Can you explain what best value contracting is, so that we kind of know what that is, and what we're actually opening up here by saying that they can have kind of an unlimited best value contract? And the second question is this. Is are there any counties now that operate, or counties or cities that operate on a 4-day work week? I mean, I know that's being taken off of the mandate. Are there any counties or cities doing it now?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, right now they're required by law to be open for 5 weekdays, business days. I'm going to let Ms. O'Rourke actually answer the best values contracting question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jennifer O'Rourke again with the League of Cities. That would be, best value is described in Article 2, which begins on page 14 of the actual bill.
and Mr. Rourke, that was a bill last year that Representative Hilstrom carried, and I helped co-author. There was provisions put in there to limit the number of projects a city or a county could do in a year to try and, because it's a little bit complicated how the procedure works, and to make sure that people know how to do it before they can do it, learn to walk before they run, and they're just taking out the limit on the number of projects. There's not changing anything on the law besides that. And I think that's beyond our purview, but that explains what we're trying to do here with what they were trying to do here with that part of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this question could be answered by any or all of Ms. O'Rourke, Mr. Sulin, Ms. Kelleher, Mr. Matthews, or Mr. Carlson, who I see standing at the ready. Representative Lanning, the repealer takes out a significant notice in the newspaper, and I've been looking at mandate relief from the perspective of things that we can do that where the public service is very minimal, but the cost is significant. And thinking about whether this is enough, whether of the five who are here to testify on behalf of local units of government, whether this is significant in terms of budget savings on the newspaper publishing, or if there is more that we can do and that we can find alternative ways of posting. Just from my experience in my mid to small-sized county, Chisago County, the cost is in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands, just for the communities in my area. And so I'm wondering whether we're doing enough and whether it's something that we can take on today and don't need a council to go further.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, I think the local units of government would like to have more publication elimination in this bill. The only one that's eliminated in here is the Truth in Taxation published notice. They're still required to publish the notification about to taxpayers what they're proposing to do, and they're going to still send out to all the taxpayers what they're proposing to do, and giving them an opportunity to interact or come to a meeting to express their concern or question. We decided not to put in more elimination of publication notices here because of the controversy that would come from that. We very clearly in the process heard that there would be a lot of controversy if we tried to eliminate too many public published notices. Mr. Carlson, perhaps, would also like to comment on that.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Kalin, with regards to the savings that we get through the truth and taxation provisions in this bill, the elimination of the hearing and the elimination of the advertisement, based on a survey that the Department of Revenue did back in 2007, that would be about a $570,000 savings to all levels of local government in Minnesota. You're accurate that obviously the mailed notice is the most expensive part of the truth and taxation system. Eliminating that would save us roughly $2.9 million. And obviously, we would like to avoid the cost, but I don't necessarily want to reduce the amount of information. If we could find some alternative manner, such as posting on our websites, we would certainly welcome that in lieu of the mail notice. But that gives you, I think, the dimensions, the parameters of what we're talking about.
And Mr. Carlson, could you identify yourself for the tape?
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association.
Mr. Matthews?
Sulin,
yes. Hi. Cheers.
Ken Sulin with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And just to address Representative Kalin's question and also indirectly then Representative Eastland's question, we, too, had supported broader publication relief efforts. When we surveyed our members, we were told that an average township notice for various things ranges anywhere from $75 to $750 per publication, depending on the type of newspaper and the size of the notice. But because of the controversy, it didn't seem like this bill was the place for it to be done. Ms. Nieren has indicated that she'd work with our association on identifying some alternative newspapers that would perhaps be more cost-effective and more widely distributed in the rural areas that would offer some flexibility. So it's an issue we definitely want to keep the dialogue on, but in the spirit of having something move, it seemed like this was not the place. With that, I don't know if there's other questions, or if I can highlight our other the other sections of the bill, but whatever the chair would like. Kayla?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning and representatives of the local units of government. I can very much appreciate the controversy. I think that there's been a bill already introduced that would dramatically reduce the printed notice. I just want to be clear to the public and that we're not talking about eliminating notice. It's merely the means of providing that notice. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a fundamentally changed year and changed budget for the state, and I think that there are, when we know something that we can do, I think we should do as much of that as we possibly can. And, you know, I'm willing to back you up on Representative Lanning and continue to work to find more ways that we can provide notice through a more efficient manner. I will point out that last year a lot of us stood with Representative Pawlowski in opposing the reduced notice requirement for foreclosures, which was it continues to be a significant revenue source for the newspapers. And so I think that there are ways that we can find a balance here, but that we can go deeper and really help out while making sure that, I think, Mr. Carlson, we should talk more about whether, I'm sure you've done this research, but whether a postcard or other with very, or a larger mailer, but not quite the full Truth and Taxation mailer, you know, whether people can opt out by electronic means or whether you can actually get a postcard that just has the link as well as a phone number. I know my constituents who don't have access, if they read a short notice in the paper that said you can go to this website or call a phone number, they will call that phone number. I think Representative Lanning, you and I have constituents that will call us all the time to get that information. So I'd like to keep pursuing this issue because I think it's going to be one of the most cost-effective changes we can make.
Mr. Sullivan, you want to...
Mr. Chair, while TNT notices are not directly a township issue, they are a cost savings to us. I just recently learned that it's very common practice for the county to charge one-third of the cost back to their local township. So the numbers that Mr. Carlson just shared actually would result in a cost savings for us as well. The specific sections that we brought forward as an association that were included in this bill would be Article 2, Section 3 on fence viewer compensation. And for those of you who have never had the privilege of serving in a rural township with major livestock issues, it's a very common practice for two warring neighbors just fighting over what the fence should be and who should pay for it to come to the town board under Chapter 344 and demand a fence viewing. An existing law caps the compensation to the township at $60, even though under current battles there are usually multiple hearings, multiple viewings, and multiple orders that have to go out. And this change would follow the what's currently used for cartways by saying, look, we'll do the job, but we're not going to ask the taxpayers to subsidize it, put up the security deposit, you know, maybe a couple $100, we'll finish it off and not subsidize it. Section 4, there's a provision of law that mandates that any public cemetery that has been abandoned for 10 years, located within township boundaries, automatically becomes a township. That gets to be an issue for us over maintenance costs and the fact that there are seldom records as to who owns what, who is buried where. And this just makes it clear that we have some flexibility on saying we'll continue doing the basic routine maintenance so it doesn't become a weed yard, and showing respect. You may recall last year there was a bill to give us flexibility on spending the revenues to show proper respect in a cemetery, but that we can keep things from becoming worse by limiting or prohibiting new burials. Section 6 is Ms. O'Rourke referred to Section 7. Section 6 was one brought forth by the Township Association. Again, doing like Section 7, just correcting an oversight from last year when we increased the bid threshold. This just corrects the oversight. We also support Article or Sections 1 and Section 2 of Article 3, but we'll discuss that in more detail in the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Can you identify yourself too, I think?
Ken Sullivan with the Minnesota Association of Townships.
Thank you. And Representative Biskin, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick one, and it's going back to Levy Limits. So I'll be the author of the bill, Representative Lanning. Is it my understanding that under current law, levy limits cease to exist for taxes levied in 2011 and beyond? And so the net effect of your repealer is simply to repeal levy limits for taxes payable in 2010, seeing as the taxes payable in 2009 have already been certified?
Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskins, I'd like Ms. Dalton to answer that.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, levy limits were imposed for 3 years, pay 2009, pay 2010, pay 2011, and this would essentially eliminate the levy limits for pay 2010 and pay 2011.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, I don't, as I'm reading the statutory language, I see it's for taxes levied in 2009 and 2010, so I suppose if it's levied in 2010, then it's payable in 2011. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any more questions? Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I know the hour is getting late, so I just continue to be troubled by the Section 9 in Article 2. I think I agree with Reverend Scal, Representative.
I think I need a prayer for this one.
I think we're all having trouble with our.
I'm in need of a prayer right now.
Did I promote? I think I did. Representative Scalzi's point about some disturbing precedents on collective bargaining, and I do believe that the other disturbing precedent in this is making early retirement not necessarily a choice for some people, and it does need to be an option, so that when we start mucking around with collective bargaining and legislation and then limiting employees' choices, I think there's some concerns. I'm sympathetic overall to this bill, and I'm very sympathetic to a lot of the other sections in it. But I would move, Mr. Chair, that we delete this this section. My oral amendment would be to delete Article 2, Section 9.
Make sure we have staff. Do you have that in writing? Okay. Does everybody understand the amendment? Our Representative Hornstein moves to delete Article 2, Section 9 of House File 1195. Discussion, yes. Any questions, discussion on the amendment? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all due respect to Representative Hornstein, I certainly understand your concern, the concern of others that have talked to you. I would respectfully like to request that if we could have some further discussion about this before we take the provision out of here. It seems to me that what we're doing, instead of saying that, we're saying, first of all, that local unit of government must allow a former employee to be in the group plan. That's still in here, and that's not changing. What has changed is giving local units of government, instead of requiring them to have a former employee and dependents in the same group, it's a local option. And it would seem to me that then leaves us to the bargaining process, that this would be something that would be bargained between the unions and the school boards or county boards. Ms. Dalton, is that the correct interpretation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, yes.
Ms. Dalton. Don't want to demote you. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning is correct. This is permissive language. It does not require that somebody stop pooling. They can continue to pool. But then it becomes really a cost-benefit analysis for the local government between the cost of that pooling and the cost on current employees compared to the cost on early retirees.
Any more questions or testimony? Mr. Carlson, you've got your hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I didn't get an opportunity to testify on our provisions, and I will just address this one provision. We, too, do support the provision in the Lanning bill. I think what's being forgotten here is the counterbalancing side, that right now the practical effect of the current required pooling is that the active employees pay more. So that the retirees can pay less. The effect of this provision with the often cited GASB 45, which is a national accounting standard, is that every local government in Minnesota has to identify their long-term costs for these. And these are literally tens of millions of dollars solely because of this provision right here. We are encouraged, not required, to amortize that liability. And ultimately, then, if we do follow through on the recommendations of the accounting standards, our taxpayers are paying for that difference. So it's not only our active employees, but also it's our taxpayers who ultimately pay for the reduced premiums that retirees have to pay. Again, this has no effect, as Ms. Schwab indicated, on current retirees. It's just future retirees who could be affected, and they do have a choice. They can delay their retirement if the additional premium would be so costly as to be a consideration.
Representative Hornstein, do you want to respond?
Well, no, I mean, just very quickly, and I think Mr. Thorson is here as well. On the collective bargaining, yes, literally, but I do think it sends a difficult message when you say a local unit of government is not required to pool. You know, we get into some semantics, but the broader issue here is that I think it does increase costs, and it puts a chilling effect on, you know, those that are considering early retirement. I mean, that's not a minor matter, and, you know, I don't amend bills, especially my pal from the class of 2002. I don't do this lightly or, you know, just willy-nilly. I think it is an important issue, and that's why I offered this. So, you know, I think, but I know Mr. Thorson may be able to respond directly to Mr. Carlson and some of the broader issues.
And Mr. Thorson, would you identify yourself with the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5, and we're opposed to Article 2, Section 9 of this bill, and essentially it seeks to give local governments the authority to create a separate risk pool for retirees, and we believe the effect of that on early retirees would be to essentially price them out of the health insurance market. Today, both federal COBRA and many state COBRA require retirees to be allowed in the same risk pool as the current employees for a defined period of time. Local governments, by state law, are required through age 65 to extend that same opportunity for retired employees. So presumably after COBRA would kick out, it would allow local governments to make that change and then permit them to create the two risk pools. Again, I think Representative Hornstein said it well. I think it takes the price of an early retirement out of reach for these individuals, and I think it's going to create additional pressure then on local government budgets now to have that movement in the workforce. We, again, oppose this change to the law.
Representative Eastland, do you have a question?
Yeah, a question or comment. I guess, first of all, my question was answered. They said it was going to cost more money. I understand the concern for the individual that's retired that may have that retires early that chooses that option and has to pay a little bit more. But I mean, well,
at least what I'm thinking about here is concerned about how we can best use public dollars. And I would think that the pool is going to experience a reduction in costs if people choose this early retirement package and opt for early retirement. It seems reasonable to me that somebody would make that decision based on the economic realities that they know. And one of the things they would know is that my insurance rates are probably going to go up a little bit because I'm going to be pooled with people that are in my same circumstance. It seems kind of unreasonable that the taxpayers just continue to pay a higher cost for somebody that's no longer an employee. I mean, I just think we kind of got two issues here working. And I think seeing as this isn't going to force anybody to change their situation right now, nobody would go into this unless they know what the options are. This would seem to be a very reasonable approach to go that would give counties the ability to look at what's most cost effective for them in providing these services. Just a comment, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had a question.
Yeah, I guess I just want to bring up that some of these ones that are retiring are like our law enforcement employees that have a real stressful occupation, and then usually that's common for them to retire after 20 years and then in their 50s, and it may be a public safety issue if our law enforcement people see about hanging on longer instead of, retiring after their 20 years of stressful occupation, allowing some new officers to fill their spots.
Any more questions or comments? Anybody else wish to testify on the amendment? For or against? All in favor of the Representative Hornstein's amendment to delete Article 2, Section 9 out of House File 1195, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The ayes have. Motion prevails. The motion is adopted. On the rest of the bill, any more questions or comments from the audience? If not, we'll proceed to a vote on House File 1195 as amended to pass and to be re-referred to local government, government operations. All in favor? Signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed as amended. Thank you. The next bill on the agenda is House File 1278, Representative Sterner. And there's some people here. I want to get to this because these people came a long way to testify on this bill. Representative Stern, do you want to make a motion on your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1278 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections.
Good job. proceed with your testimony.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1278.
Before you start, yes. Be quick and concise and move forward on this because we're past 6 o'clock. And
okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. But House File 1278 was inspired by this committee when one of our counties came forward to allow the process of the consideration of appointing the auditor or the recorder for treasurer. And so these are bills that have came forward to us in the past. And I'm just looking to set up a policy and allowing local counties to have the right to be able to do their own jurisdiction where they want appointed or elected officials. And currently we have 27 counties that have appointed positions for the recorder, auditor, or treasurer, and I wanted to make sure that this does not include the county attorney or the county sheriff. Those are elected in all 87 counties and will remain so. Currently, the 27 counties makes up about 3.7 million people, which is roughly 70% of our Minnesota citizens, and the process has occurred since 1967, so it's not a new feature. And with me, I have Joe Matthews with Minnesota counties, who is celebrating their centennial this year of representing Minnesota counties for several years, but can talk about the process in more detail.
Mr. Matthews, if you want to identify yourself for the tape.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. As Representative Stern said, this is not a new issue. I'll just be really concise here. The bill really essentially requires an 80% majority on the county board to move forward with this issue. After the board votes, prior to the board voting, there needs to be two public notices and a public hearing to involve the local community in this decision-making process. Afterwards, if the board doesn't address concerns at the hearing, there is a process in the legislation to allow for a petition and reverse referendum. That's just the broad strokes of the bill. This is identical to language that's been used when individual counties have come forward in the past. Just a few other comments. I just want to say clearly, AMC does strongly support this legislation. We really think that the county boards ought to be able to make the offices of auditor, treasurer, and recorder appointed rather than elected if they choose. This bill does not change, make that change on its own. It would have to be a local decision-making process. Over the past several years, the legislature has passed several pieces of special legislation for counties on a case-by-case basis, and what we're really trying to do is just kind of put this issue to rest so that future counties, if they decide to go down this route, don't have to come and seek special legislation. They can just go through the local process. As Representative Stirner mentioned, in 1967, Hennepin County has granted the authority to appoint their auditor, treasurer, and recorder, and over the last 40 years, another 26 counties have gone down the same route. I should point out that cities actually appoint their city clerks, which have some of the similar duties to the county auditor. You know, as these jobs grow in complexity and require greater skills, more and more counties are pursuing special legislation to appoint these offices, not because we have any concerns about the quality of those currently serving office, but going forward, we're finding it challenging to find individuals who will run. And also, we're finding that some folks who would be well qualified for these positions are hesitant to run for a job that they might only hold for one term, which would be 4 years. And quite honestly, this is a very highly skilled and technical job, and some of the folks that we're trying to recruit to these positions have very lucrative careers in the private sector. And so if we can offer them some certainty about their position, we think that'd be a good thing. Again, I want to point out what this bill does not do. It does not make any of these offices appointed. It just allows the local county board to make that decision. And also I want to point out that there have been three counties in the past that have had the petition filed and a reverse referendum to stop this process. So it does work. There's real teeth in there. In closing, I just want to emphasize that AMC strongly believes that all counties should be granted the authority to make decisions in an open and transparent process about whether to fill the offices of auditor, treasurer, or recorder by election or appointment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions for the committee. I've distributed for you a map that shows the 27 counties that are appointing at least one of their role officers. I think there's 14 that appoint all of them.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Diskin.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I have it to the bill.
Okay.
Do we have any more testifiers?
Do we have more testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I also have Mr. Tilley represents Dakota County, the county I live in, and they've had went to appointed positions for the last 10 years. So, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Dakota County Board of Commissioners. And I should say the Dakota County Board has not taken a position on this issue, but Representative Sterner just asked me to relate the experiences that we've had in Dakota County.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, in 1991, the county board got special legislation to merge the office of auditor and treasurer and appoint the recorder. And in 1998, we got special legislation that allowed us to appoint the now merged auditor treasurer. And both of those pieces of special legislation had the reverse referendum provision. Nobody filed a petition. There's been no disruption to service. All of the incumbent members, elected members,
stayed in those offices until their retirement, with the exception of one who is still serving and has not yet retired. We've had no complaints, no negative feedback. It's all worked very good. Well.
Thank you, Mr. Shelley. And could Larry Jacobs and Michelle Ash come down? And I know you guys have traveled a little bit of distance. And thank you for waiting. We want to make sure we get her tonight. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you say your name for the record? And
yes, sir. My name is Larry Jacobs. I am the current Renville County Auditor Treasurer. I've been in office since 1999. I'm in opposition to House File 1278 for a couple of the following reasons. I believe the voters want to choose their own representation, and that's as evident as 2008, the Redwood County question on the ballot was, should the commissioners appoint the auditor, treasurer, and recorder, and the results were 2-1 against. I think that's pretty indicative of the feelings out in the community. I just question why we should take the decision away from the voters. I think that the same wise voters that elect our commissioners can also elect our auditors, our treasurers, and our recorders. Right now, I mean, there's 8 CPAs that are auditors in our state, 6 or so former state auditors. So the people that fill these positions are very knowledgeable. I believe that the question has come forward before. There is a tried and true method, Minnesota Statute 375, which allows individual counties to make their own decisions. I think that has worked well in the past, and I think it will work well going forward. So I represent MACO, that's the Minnesota Association of County Officers, and that association entails all the county auditors, the treasurers, and the recorders in all 87 counties, both the elected and the appointed, and our members support the current law, 375A.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Ash, please state your name for the record. And
my name is Michelle Ash. I'm here representing the Minnesota County Recorders Association. I serve on their legislative committee. To reiterate what Mr. Jacobs said, I am a county recorder. I have been since 1999, and I'm currently serving in my third term. We feel strongly that 375A in its current form serves well. There are already several methods in place for those counties that wish to change to change elected offices to appointed. Referendum initiated by the county board, a referendum initiated by a recommendation of a government study commission, a referendum initiated by a petition of 5% of the voters, or special legislation. All those things are already in place and they already work well. By eliminating the referendum requirement, which this legislation would do, voters are denied the opportunity to exercise their voice. Because of the important issue of changing the form of local government, the state needs to leave the referendum requirement in place or we risk devaluing the process. Some county officers are elected while others are appointed. The choice needs to be left up to the voters and the taxpayers of each individual county instead of the county board. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ash. Now, Representative Biskins, you had questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. And first start with a comment, and maybe it's all comment and food for thought for Representative Sterner, because I'm not quite sure you know what you're getting into. All right. As I look at the bill language on lines 2.25 and beyond, right, if you look at the timelines, Representative Sterner, it says that the board must publish once each week for 2 consecutive weeks, and then here's the key words, in the official publication of the county. Now, Representative Sterner, I don't know about Dakota County, but I'll tell you about Scott County. Scott County each year rotates amongst its municipalities where its official publication is. The official publication currently in Scott County is the Belle Plaine Herald. Belle Plaine is a city of about 5,000 people in a much larger county of Scott. I can tell you right now that very few people in Jordan, which is 7 miles from Scott County, get the Belle Plaine Herald. And I would think percentage-wise, it'd be almost nil that anybody in Shakopee or Prior Lake or Savage or New Prague or Elko New Market get the Belle Plaine Herald. So now you're notifying the public in a publication that very few people will read. Now here's where the real kicker is, Representative Sterner, that really gives me grave concern. It says here that the resolution can be adopted just upon the motion of the commissioners unless within 30 days after that second publication you can scrounge up the required number of voters to submit a request or to submit a petition. There is no reverse referendum in this bill, Representative Sterner. Reverse referendum means you can undo what the board did. Right? But if you read the language that you have here, you publish once, you publish again, the board can act. So if the publications come 2 weeks before the board meeting, they publish once, they publish again, then the board meets and passes the resolution, now have 30 days to submit the referendum. You have less than 45 days as a member of the public to act on this. And once, if you fail to meet that very narrow timeline, as I read the rest of the bill, oh well, so sorry, you're out of luck. Because there is no reversing what the board just did within this language. So I do have grave concerns about the language. You know, if a municipality wants to do this and there is fair notice to the voters ahead of time so that the voters can weigh in, God bless. But I don't think the situation currently as written gives the voters fair notice.
Mr. Matthews, Mr. Representative Sterner, who wants to respond?
If I could, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, I think Representative Viskins really highlights why counties and other municipalities are trying to look away from the newspaper as their only means of publication. We'd love to use our website. We'd love to use other means to get it out. I would assume that if counties have those resources, they'll do that. As far as the concern about the filing, as I mentioned, there are three counties that have had this exact same process where they have had the petition filed and there is the reverse referendum. I think it ties into the comments of the testifiers in opposition. We think the local community should decide whether they need a referendum or not. And honestly, right now the state says you have to have a referendum. If there is not opposition in the community, if this is not a concern, if people are in support, why should they go through the rigmarole of the referendum? And I think that's what we're really asking for here is for the local community to decide so that instead of sitting here in St. Paul talking about whether they can have this authority, they could be in their county boardroom where the citizens themselves could show up and express their concern. And I think that's what we're trying to do is take this discussion out of St. Paul and put it back in the county boardroom.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And rigmarole is an interesting word when it comes to
voter
rights. I have no problem with the premise.
Mm-hmm.
Right? However, Mr. Chair and Representative Sterner, to you specifically, if you just really think about the timelines you're laying out, you think about busy working people in their lives, the timeline to get out information is way too short. Right? And again, we're using the words reverse referendum, but there is no reverse referendum in this bill. A reverse referendum occurs when the board does something and the voters have the chance to reverse it. This is a forward referendum in a very, very narrow time frame, 30 days to be exact, in which to collect at least 10% of registered voters in the county signature. I agree. Let the locals decide. But create a fair playing field. This language doesn't do that.
Ms. Dyson, do you have any insight for us on what Representative Fiskin is speaking about here?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Fiskins has expressed his concerns with the language
the drafting, people use the term reverse referendum too as a shorthand. That's all I'll say. It's a shorthand to talk about this particular approach to deciding matters. That's all.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews.
One last comment, Mr. Chair. There was a mention that there's concern about giving people a chance to choose. One of the concerns I mentioned earlier is the fact that it's getting more and more difficult in small rural counties to find folks to run. There are 46 counties in which no rural officer had any opposition. That could be that they're all doing a great job, but moving forward, if there's not enough interest, that's where we're getting a lot of concern from our counties, is that we need to be able to keep finding people to run for those offices. Thank you.
Representative Biskins? Representative Eastland. Yeah, that's on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all of these bills we're doing today, talking about efficiency of government and all that stuff, but I think some of my questions were related to what Representative Biskins talked about, but we all keep hearing about the difficulty of getting voters to be involved and the difficulty to get response out of the local electorate. And so our response is, let's figure out how to do it without them. And I guess the concern I've got, I mean, in a situation like this, if there's nobody that files, I mean, that's one circumstance. But, you could put up another scenario that, well, maybe there's somebody that really, for some reason, the chair of the county board doesn't want to have the auditor that's there anymore, and so they figure out a way to pass this before the next election so they can have the freedom to hire and not hire that person back. I just see some issues here that concern me, but I sympathize with the fact that it's getting more and more difficult to find people to step up to the plate and run. I'm always hesitant when we take a situation and find a solution that's just kind of a blanket solution that really takes the rights away from a lot of voters. Not every jurisdiction is having trouble finding people to run, and granted, this doesn't require them to do that, but I think, the process here could be used, I think, to move ahead in some situations that may create some controversy. I just feel more comfortable if there is a way for the voters to be directly involved, and I agree with Representative Biskins on that point.
Yeah, thank you. I guess, somewhat they're involved through their county commissioners, Mr. Eastland, because their county commissioners are their elected voice in this case. So, point taken.
Representative Landon, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sterner, to this point about the time frame, changing 30 to 60, it seems to me would address concern about just inadequate time, especially in the kind of situation that Representative Biskins talks about. Just want to offer that as a suggestion here, that maybe that's one way to improve the timeline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning. I would encourage that change, if that would make it much more palatable to go from 30 days to 60 days on the bill.
Did you want to repeat that? Are you offering it as an amendment, or?
Mr. Chairman, I offered it as a suggestion. Representative Sterner could, if he wishes to accept it, could just offer to an oral amendment.
And I accepted it and will offer it as an oral amendment.
So, Ms. Dyson, did you get that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the proposed oral amendment is on page 2, line 30, delete 30, insert 60.
Representative Sterner, is that what your amendment?
Yes, it is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you just want to incorporate that in your bill? Or?
Yes, I would. Yes, absolutely. Discuss.
Any more questions about discussion about the bill? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, I'm all in favor of the bill. House File 1278. Oh, amendment? Oh. We have to vote on, okay. We have to vote on the amendment. I'm being corrected here. So Representative Sterner moves. What's that? Let's just for make sure we have any problems down the road. Representative Sterner moves to amend his bill on line 2.3, line, or page 2, line 30, to delete the third, the 30 and add and insert 60. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And now there's on the bill. Is there any more discussion on the bill? Okay, all in favor of the bill as amended, House File 1278 to be moved and to be passed, and be moved to passed as amended and re-referred to the House, to local government, or to government operations. I'm not going to repeat the whole thing. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Good comfort. Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein moves the minutes from the last meeting, March 2nd, 2009. All those in favor, please say aye. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Motions are meetings adjourned.